Hi, and welcome to episode 109 of the Studio Insider Art Podcast. In today's episode, I'm chatting again with Stephen Patterson, the CEO of one of my favourite paint brands, Derevan Matisse. Stephen and I first chatted in episode 96, so if you'd like to hear more about his journey with this fabulous and innovative Australian paint brand, then be sure to go and check out that in the archives. We identified in that conversation that we both had a fascination with colour and the history of pigment, and I thought it would be great to have another chat, this time focusing on Stephen's vast knowledge in these areas. So join us as we dive deep into how it is that we actually see colour and how the pigments in paints that you know and use today came into being. There are so many bizarre and fascinating stories to unpack as we zone in and look at the history of the colour blue. I also just wanted to send a big thank you to all of you out there who came along to my exhibition opening on this Saturday just past the 5th of November. It was so beautiful to share my work and this experience with so many dear friends and also new friends, many of whom are listeners to this podcast that I'd not met before. But if you weren't able to make it for the opening, I am going to be in the Old Butcher's Shop Gallery at 112 Seymour Street, Soldiers Hill, Ballarat, from 1 until 5 p.m. every Saturday and Sunday throughout November, except for the 20th. And there is going to be a super special event on the 19th when Steph and I will be recording a live podcast episode, including a live audience Q&A in the gallery at 3 p.m. So if you'd like to be part of that, be sure to come on down. All the details are in the show notes. Okay, now let's get on with the episode. I'm Suze Nethercutt, and this is the Studio Insider Art Podcast, where I open up about what it's really like to be a professional artist. Whether I'm having chats with my studio bestie, Steph, interviewing inspiring creatives, or answering listener questions, there's something here for every established and emerging artist. My mission is that my journey will help you feel a bit more at home in your own. Hi, Stephen.
Hi, how are you going?
I'm good. How are you?
Yeah, really well, thank you.
Thanks for joining me again on the podcast. I'm so delighted to have you on again. We did chat back earlier in February on episode 96, which was awesome, and we had a great conversation about your story and the story of Derevan. It was an awesome chat.
Yeah, it was cool.
But we did feel like there was a bit more to explore, especially around your incredible knowledge about pigment and colour, and I thought it'd be great to do a few more episodes where we can dig a bit deeper on some of these areas. So thanks so much for coming on again to deepen our understanding of colour and pigment.
Yeah, hopefully I'll do that. Thank you.
Now, I thought it would be great to start off by getting right back to the basics of colour. Now, us painters spend a lot of time thinking about and working with colour, but I wonder if you could explain for us, from a scientific perspective, how it is we actually see colour.
Yeah, sure. And look, I think it's a really good idea to have a basic understanding of how we see colour, especially when it comes to mixing colour down the track, or that we'll talk about down the track, because it allows us to sort of understand the workings going on behind how we're creating what we're creating. It's pretty simple. Basically, and I'm sure we're all aware of this, color is energy, is wavelengths. We measure it in wavelengths and frequency, you know, the same as we use a ruler to measure up our canvas. And so we talk about wavelengths, and basically that energy measured in wavelengths, detected by the rods and cones in the eyes. And I won't go into a whole heap of detail there, but a signal, that energy, when it hits the rods and cones, sends a signal through to the brain that's commensurate with that particular color or wavelength. Right. And so from there, probably talking about wavelengths and color additives when we mix color. And basically there's two ways of mixing color, and we'd all be aware of these but might not be cognizant. there's what's termed additive color mixing and subtractive color mixing. And additive color mixing is where light is emitted from a source or is generated by a source. Nowadays, it's nearly always electricity, you know, lights. It can be heat energy. You know, we see metals when they're red hot or white hot. And that's additive. When we mix those colors, it's called additive color mixing. And the perfect example for that is a screen, a TV screen, a phone, a tablet, whatever, where we're using the three colors of red, blue, and green in combination to give a vast array of different colors. And that's pretty simple. I think most people understand that, but that's light being produced, okay? Mm-hmm. When we talk about subtractive color mixing, and this is the one we're more interested in because this is what we do when we mix colors for paint or pastels or whatever. And with additive color mixing, if you look at it on a graph, when you put two colors together, they're combining because there's more energy, let's say. When we look at subtractive color mixing, what we're actually doing is there's less energy. Subtractive color mixing is when we're looking at light reflecting off something. So it's actually the, I'll call it white light just to differentiate it, but normal sunlight, if you like.
Mm-hmm.
Is bouncing off something, being reflected off something, and we see a color. So that's reflected light. When we see, so for instance, when we see blue paint or yellow paint, we're seeing white light hit that and particular wavelengths being given off. So when we mix blue and yellow together, we know we get green. But what's actually happening, if you were to look at this on a graph of blue and green, I keep saying blue and green. If you were to
blue
look
and yellow, I know what you mean.
If you were to look at this on a graph of blue and yellow, when you mix the two, if we were doing additive or these were a blue and yellow light, they would have more energy because they add together. And this is kind of mathematical and we won't bother getting into the maths and the physics of it. But when you mix the blue and yellow together, when we're mixing paint, as they come together, they basically, they don't cancel each other out, but they reduce in intensity, okay?
Right.
And that's just at that point, I'll just mention, that's why when we mix a few colors together on our palette, we end up with brown.
Yes, right, because you're cancelling the intensity out of each individual
exactly
wavelength.
Right. That's right. In theory, all the colours mixed together, if you took all your colours, you'd end up with black. Mm-hmm. Generally, you end up with a murky sort of brown colour in reality. So that's subtractive colour mixing.
That's so interesting that there's really two different ways that we see it. I didn't realise there was that distinction. And I was also fascinated to learn that humans haven't always seen colour in the way that we do now. Can you tell us a bit about the history of how humans see colour and how this sense has become more awakened over time, particularly in relation to the colour blue?
Sure. Look, and I think this is really interesting as well because, you know, we grow up and probably for at least a couple of centuries, really knowing about the full, as young kids, knowing about the full spectrum of colours, you know, the rainbow and that sort of thing.
Mm.
But researchers in going back, and of course, when you're going back millennia, you don't know 100% if this is true, but certainly in references, not every colour had a name going back thousands of years. In fact, more recently, I think it was Jules Davidoff working with a tribe in Namibia in about 2006, did some tests with basically a circle of 11 segments of greens that were very closely matched and then one segment that was blue and asked them to pick out anything that was different. And while they could differentiate between several of the greens that to us we would think were very, very close, they didn't pick the blue out and they didn't have a name for that as a separate blue. So the belief is that back millennia ago, not only did we not have a name for blue, and blue in particular, blue was one of the last colours that we think was named, but we had no, and the theory goes, we had no reason to actually know what blue was or to even care about blue, because the only things, and we'll talk about this a little bit later, but the only things that we perceive as blue are really the sky and, let's say, the ocean or water, because there's really not a lot in nature that is blue, that is truly blue. And moreover, there was not a lot of food that was blue. And that's really the theory, that we didn't much care about it because it wasn't a lot of use to us.
A result of the evolutionary brain.
Yeah. That's yeah. Certainly the theory anyway, yeah.
So interesting, especially coming at it from now where blue is such a beloved colour. I know that as a painter that they gravitate toward blue in a very passionate way. So it's really, really fascinating to hear.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, it's so interesting to understand the mechanisms by which we actually perceive colour. And as artists, and I guess for you as a paint manufacturer, the colour that we're working with comes from pigment. What are some of the earliest pigments that were used by early humans to make art?
Okay. I guess, and once again, this is theory because we don't know what happened, you know, 300
yeah, of course.
Or 700,
we'll preface the whole conversation with it's all theoretical.
Yeah. But I mean, what we do have is what's left behind. Mm-hmm. So really, There's a lot of artwork and small sculptures and rock cuttings that have been found that have been dated back sort of 300,000 to 700,000 years old, but we don't have too many 2D paintings, let's say. And so rather than artifacts, we're obviously just concentrating more on paintings because they're carvings and things. There's no colour left on them, the very old ones. So they may well have been coloured with something, but we don't really know. Really, we can only go back to about 40,000 years ago, which was just when the Neanderthals were kind of on their way out and Homo sapiens on the way in. And we have, I thought I read just recently something else had been discovered that they were sort of saying was about 60,000 years old, some cave paintings. But basically we're talking that sort of time frame. So whilst we have artwork or artifacts that are much older, let's say painted coatings, 2D sort of paintings, seem to have only been around, say, 40 to 60,000 years. And yes, the pigments that we used, or at least those that are left behind, tend to be the ochres, the red and the yellow ochre, which are naturally forming and are found in many places around the world. And we'd be aware of those, you're calling them red oxide or red ochre and yellow ochre. And of course, using carbon from fires, you know, charcoal, grinding that down. And also as a white, I guess, for our, you know, what we'd call a white, calcium carbonate, which once again sort of is readily found around the place.
Okay, so all those beautiful natural pigments, which we're very familiar with through Indigenous art in Australia especially.
Yeah. I mean, look, we're pretty sure that other colourants were used with fabrics and that sort of thing, but of course none of those have lasted.
And then we have this leap when the Egyptians make the first manufactured pigment that we know about, which has permanency. But for much of the Middle Ages in the Western world, it was mainly naturally derived pigments that were used for paint and fabric dyeing. Is that right?
That's exactly right. I mean, up until, as we say, there's nothing sort of remaining of the fabrics or dyes of, you know, beautiful colours until the Egyptians came around, where we have inscriptions and still some paintings left behind. And so we'd kind of say that the Egyptian blue is the first manufactured blue. You know, we talked about the oxides before, and mm-hmm. if you like, I mean, the black, carbon black, it could have just been that they, you know, rubbed a bit of black on their hands, went, oh, that doesn't come off easily, you know, we'll try that. But certainly it would appear that the Egyptians actually were manufacturing, they meant to manufacture the Egyptian blue. And it's not, strictly speaking, it's not really a pigment. It's actually just, it's a glass or a glass frit. But still, it was used as a pigment and used as a colouring on walls and artefacts. So you'd kind of say, yes, that was pretty well the first pigment, which is still a pretty long time ago.
It is a pretty long time ago. And then so it was just sort of plants and berries and things that they were deriving pigment from to dye up cloth, et cetera, which is a different process to painting, but sort of the first emergence is in that plant world, isn't it?
That's exactly right. And, I mean, just the sheer fact that we have no remnants of those coloured cloths, although we're pretty sure that they existed, it shows the way that those dyes just didn't stand up. I mean, obviously the fabric they're on, I guess, as well. But they are on wall. It was predominantly work was done on walls. If they are there, they don't particularly show themselves as mm-hmm. such. The Mayan ones, which we will probably talk about in a sec, were still using a dye, but the different. Yeah.
Okay. Awesome. So, and it was in the 1700s, I believe, that the first purely synthesized pigment was created, and we enter into this world of science and color becoming intertwined. Can you tell us a bit about that first pigment that was created?
Friends, my first solo exhibition is currently underway at the Old Butcher's Shop Gallery, 112 Seymour Street, Soldiers Hill, Ballarat, this November 2022. And if you're in town, I really hope you stop by and say hi. I'm in the gallery every Saturday and Sunday from 1 till 5 for the whole of November, except the 20th. And if you'd like to connect personally with Steph and I and participate in a live recording of a special podcast episode, including a live audience Q&A, then come down to the gallery at 3 p.m. on Saturday, the 19th of November. If you're not in my hometown, be sure to head on over to my art website, susannethercutt.com/autumnal-dreamscapes-exhibition to check out the web version. All the links are in the show notes, and I hope to see you there.
Yeah. So, you know, you went from Egyptian times where it was probably just sheer luck that they came up with the frit and sort of, which would have been from effectively just burning silica, burning sand, it being heated possibly around a fire or something like that. And they realized that, you know, when it mixed with a bit of copper, once again, by chance that they found this, and then they sort of refined that. When we get to the 1700s, there was the scientific pursuit of dye makers were already around because it was, and we know that, you know, clothing was regularly dyed. And so there was an industry around that. So there was an interest rather than it just being something for the pharaohs. This was really almost a day-to-day industry. And so dye makers were around. There was a lot of dye houses, but we're talking dyes predominantly for fabric and that sort of thing, not for artist materials as such. And yep, the Swiss dye maker Johann Diesbach, I haven't met him, so I'm not sure how you pronounce his name, was actually working in a friend's, I think he was a bit down on his luck at the time, and he was working in a friend's laboratory trying to actually create a fairly standard dye at the time, which was red Florentine lake and made from the cochineal beetle. And so had all this going on, had run out of, I think it was potash, and asked his friend in the laboratory, can I borrow a bit of potash? He lent him this potash, and instead of this nice red color, He went on with his manufacturing, as it were. Instead of this nice red color, he ended up with a pretty pale, insipid color. And obviously not wanting to waste any of these materials, he then attempted to concentrate it to you know, get the red color out. And it turned first, I think it turned purple, and then went to this brilliant, intense blue color. Now, of course, right. Being a dye maker, he was very happy with that. It wasn't what he'd started out with, but he'd made something because at that point, keep in mind, there were no strong blues. There, and I believe we have some actually in Australia. There is, I think, termed a blue oxide. It's a pretty light blue, naturally forming. But really, at the time, there were no intense blues either for dyeing or for. We did have an indigo and violets, but they didn't last very long and they weren't very strong. This new blue, which is now known as Prussian blue, was a really intense blue. So he thought he was onto something. He was onto something. That was terrific. He made up batches of it, went out, was selling it, and then, of course, went to make it again and couldn't make it.
Because it's all accidents, these discoveries.
He didn't know it was an accident, but what had actually happened was chap's name was Dipple that the laboratory was working in, and he'd actually been, the potash was not straight potash. It had some ox blood in it, just a tiny bit. So it had been tainted. Luckily, his assistant had actually noted that down because had that happened, so Dysbeck went back to Dipple and said, you know, that potash I got, where'd you get it from? Because, you know, it made this brilliant blue. They worked it out and off he went. It does kind of make you wonder, had someone not been paying attention or they hadn't worked out that it had a bit of ox blood in it, which was, there's part of the chemical in that, I think it's the iron, that creates the reaction to come up with this blue, how much longer it would have taken before someone had discovered it.
Absolutely. I just love how big a role curiosity and experimentation and sheer randomness plays in the chemical discovery of Prussian blue. It's so interesting.
Yeah, it is.
And I believe that it's gone on to have some pretty wide and varied application in other industries as well, including medicine.
Yeah, absolutely. The Prussian blue actually is a really, it's funny, we use it less and less now in fine art, in painting, but it is still very much used across quite a few different industries. As you said, in medicine, I think the World Health Organization still has it as a list of an essential medicine because it's very effective at removing and radioactive cesium from the body. So you actually eat it, I think you eat it, and it will get rid of, it's a great antidote for these heavy metals and radiation poisoning. It's been used for many years in machine shops, basically made into a little paste. And when you're trying to put two parts of a machine together and line them up and perfectly have both surfaces perfectly even so they can go together, they put the paste down first, just rub it backwards and forwards, and you can see where the one area is touching against the other area and where it's not and so on.
Gosh.
Blueprints. I mean, everyone I'm sure is familiar with blueprints and, you know, the houses and architectural drawings and that sort of thing. And back before there were such things as photocopiers and that sort of machinery, when you were doing big drawings and complicated drawings, the only way of copying them was to literally copy them by hand. So they found a way of basically putting, coating paper with a mixture of I think ammonium iron citrate and potassium ferrous cyanide. So it's a little bit nasty, the components.
Sounds a bit nasty.
Yeah, and coat the paper with that, then take your drawing on some thinner paper, lay it over the top and literally put it out in the sun. And there's a reaction with the sunlight and the UV light, and the two compounds put together actually produce Prussian blue in the exposed areas, so where the lines aren't. So
right.
I don't know if you remember what blueprints look like, but they're white lines.
I totally am old enough to remember that and that the technology of carbon papers and things that we used back in the day. So yes. So fascinating, isn't that?
That's
all these different applications. And, you know, Prussian blue is one of those sort of quintessential historical pigments that we're all familiar with. What has become more popular in replacement of that? You mentioned it's not used as much anymore.
Probably.
It's not quite as popular.
Yeah, ultra blue and phthalo blue. I mean, well, phthalo blue more so, because Prussian blue is quite a green blue. So phthalo blue would be seen as replacing that,
Right. Okay. Interesting. Another gorgeous blue is cobalt blue, which appeared about a century later and also has a really interesting history of evolution. Can you tell us a little of that story?
Yeah. Look, minerals containing cobalt had been around for a long time, but scientists or dye makers or people playing around really started to refine the materials they were using and realizing that copper and cobalt, for instance, gave blue colorings to things. And so, yes, cobalt was certainly in the original sort of ubiquitous blue ceramics that we see from China. And interestingly enough, when I was looking at this, apparently when they first produced these, because of course China's been exporting for a very long time, the blue was seen as being a bit garish, a bit loud, and so that was all it was all exported predominantly.
Right, so the locals didn't actually have it in their own homes.
They thought it was a bit, wasn't that great.
Loud.
Exactly. Yeah. So that's probably why, when straight away if someone talks about Chinese ceramics, you just think blue instantly. Yeah. So that's used in there. Yeah.
And so it had a bit of an evolution in coming into being in the Western world, the cobalt. So was there another story of discovery that occurred there?
Yeah, sure. So, once again, rarely are things ever discovered uniquely in one place only. They tend, it tends to happen around the same time. And people have been, you'd probably say, didn't realize they were using cobalt, but the cobalt, the blue in a lot of the glass in some of the very old cathedrals and churches takes its blue from cobalt. And once again, they were just using a material that they knew would turn the glass blue. I don't know that they sat down and said, "Oh, Bob, pop down to the store and buy 3 pounds of cobalt." It was kind of like, "We need to get this powder from this area because that turns the glass blue." But I think once again in the 1700s, there was a Swedish chemist that, his family owned a mine, and the way they were mining, quite often a lot of the miners were becoming quite sick because once they brought the ore out, they were trying to separate out the ore. I can't remember what they were actually looking for, but it wasn't cobalt. And of course the cobalt was coming off and was actually making them sick and killing them. And so George Brandt, I've got the story right, was the son of the mine owner and was actually studying at university and did actually work out what this nasty substance was. And the miners used to call it the Swedish word for goblin or troublemaker, which was kobold.
C-O-B-A-L-D. So that's where the name comes from.
And the name stuck. It ended up with a T instead of a D, but and the name stuck because obviously they saw it as a pest. It was a It wasn't anything they were interested in when they were mining. So yeah, and that's how that came about. And from once it was refined, it was very much easier to incorporate in a whole lot of other things, not just colours, but cobalt's used in a vast number of things.
So interesting. Another accidental discovery.
Pretty much.
I really love cobalt blows, but I do get nervous about that heavy metal poisoning aspect. Is this something we still need to worry about with the more modern formulations?
Look, it's not. Probably much the same as any of the heavy metals, the cadmiums, the cobalts. When they're made nowadays, unlike in the 1700s where it was a little bit hit and miss, I think, the processes they go through to manufacture, there's no unreacted heavy metals left. So even the pigments themselves, you probably wouldn't sit down and eat them, because basically what happens with any of the heavy metals, if you ingest it, if it gets into your body, and generally that's through eating it, it goes into your gut's got acid in it, and it has a chance of them reacting with that acid, becoming free, and then going into the blood system. And once it's in the blood, it'll get pulled out of one of your organs. I think the pancreas actually is the one that does cadmium, and your liver, I think, as well. And eventually it knocks you off. With the pigments that we use nowadays, they have all been cleaned and washed in acid, so there shouldn't be any free cadmium or cobalt left. So even if you were to eat it, it should just go straight through you. So that shouldn't be an issue. Put it then in paint, and once again, as long as you're not eating it, you haven't even got a chance of breathing it in, because it's in, as long as you don't airbrush with it or atomize it in some way, just sitting down painting with it, it's not going to jump off your palette or off the canvas and attack you. You've got to get it into your body. And as I say, certainly the pigments we use are all washed so that there's no bioavailable heavy metals. And so it really shouldn't be an issue.
Well, that's good to know. Puts my mind at rest, because I love cadmium as well. Cadmium orange is one of my favourites of yours, actually. I use it all the time, and I don't think I could ever let it go.
Cool.
Now, I believe cerulean blue is also a cobalt-based pigment and another favourite of mine. Can you fill us in on a little of its history?
Yeah, it's probably more around the name. So early on in the piece, cerulean or cerulean was actually the name just given to blue, not necessarily in general, but well, the color that it is, that lighter greener sort of sky blue, if you like. And so it wasn't generally necessarily a pigment name, but over time, it was coined, I guess, in about 1805 by a chap, Hoffner, in Germany, who set out to manufacture and roasted, or in a furnace, combined cobalt and tin oxides together and came up with this chemically different colour to straight cobalt blue. And everybody would know that, cobalt blue and cerulean blue are two quite different blues. So cerulean blue is, the name came from a sort of more generic blue down to what it is today, which is that combination of cobalt and sometimes it'll have selenium in it. There's a couple of different forms of it, but it's a definite, definitely defined different colour, as it were.
Yeah, interesting. And then I guess another gorgeous blue that everyone is very familiar with and we've talked about already, which is ultramarine. That also has a long and fascinating history. Can you tell us a bit about that? Because that's one that's come down to us that's used very, very widely.
Absolutely. So ultra blue, or I guess more strictly speaking, we don't call it artificial ultramarine anymore, but that's what it is. It has a very similar makeup to lapis lazuli, and I'm sure you'd be aware of that. Mm-hmm. Now, lapis was probably the first blue. When I mentioned before about older artifacts, there are certainly carved statuettes from lapis. But the Egyptians never, and no one up until, let's say, medieval times, hadn't come up with being able to actually make a paint from lapis. Now, it certainly did make its way, and through Italy, it's actually where it gets its name. So the original lapis, and we'll differentiate them by calling them lapis and ultramarine, even though originally it was the lapis that was called ultramarine, and where that comes from is the Italian ultramarino was meant ultra, beyond, and marine, sea, and obviously very Eurocentric, but they were Italian. To them, it was beyond the sea. It came from Afghanistan, and that's, I think, still right. Where the best lapis comes from. And it was into Italy, and so that's where the name ultramarine came from, and was for several centuries. And I'm sure you're aware of this, lapis was very expensive, extremely expensive, and still is today because of the process it goes through to grind it down and levigate, which just means wash it, several times and pummel it with some gum. And there's a real process. And, you start with kilos and kilos and end up with a few grams. So it's very expensive.
Can I just interject with one little fact I remember from art history when I was at uni, which was that lapis was actually more expensive than gold as a pigment to be
absolutely
by painters. And it was always reserved for the cloak of the Virgin Mary in the religious icons in the Middle Ages, because that was the most precious expression of blue, and it was her signature colour. And I remember, and I've seen quite, if you go to medieval churches and Renaissance churches throughout Europe, you see lapis quite often in these icons, in the cloaks of the Virgin Mary.
That's exactly right. Just a little aside. And I mean, there's a lot of artist contracts that are still around where their rate of pay and all that sort of thing is included, and how much ultramarine that they're allowed to buy, and it's specifically, and it must be used. So, it was specified in the contract and that it must be on the work, because obviously they'd use whatever other blue that they could get underneath to give it, some sort of, keep in mind the paints that they used to use were not nearly as concentrated as what we have the chance to use now. And so, they were very specific about, because it was so expensive, about how it was used and specified the quantity.
Yes, that was potentially like a huge, huge thing to discover a synthetic replacement for this, like to be able to, that would be in massive demand across the world, I would imagine.
That's exactly right. And this is what brings in the society, the encouragement. I'm clearly not French. France, in the 1820s, they actually put up a reward of 6,000 francs to anyone who could develop a synthetic version of it, because they saw when you think about it, if you forget that ultramarine exists today, can you think of another ready blue that isn't violet? And they didn't have the violets, the synthetic violets we have today. So they had Prussian blue at this point. They had the cobalts, but there was no red blue. They were all green blue. And so you didn't have that nice red blue to make purples or the sky or so many things we use ultra blue for. It's one of the most popular blues, if not probably the most popular. So, in 1820s, a reward was put out. And once again, it's interesting. 100 years before that, I read Arthur Church's book. That's quite an interesting read. He says that in about 1814, I think it was St. Gabin, what turned out to be ultra blue was actually found as a contaminant, which happens as well, we'll talk about in a minute, another colour. Mm-hmm. It was found as a contaminant, but they didn't really do anything about it, but it was actually noted. And that could well have helped the two combatants who went for this 6,000 franc award. So there was a French guy, Jean-Baptiste Guermet, and a German, Christian Gmelin. And pretty well within weeks of each other, they both applied and said they'd found a way to make synthetic ultra blue. And so they then counted, and one guy said, oh, yeah, well, I actually discovered it a year ago. And the other chap said, oh, well, actually, I discovered it 2 years ago. Anyway, as was probably likely to happen, the prize was awarded to the French chemist, but it didn't matter. The main thing was that we found a way to make it synthetically, and it did indeed bring riches to Guermet. And hence we talk about French ultramarine. And so that's another name for the synthetic ultramarine versus lapis.
Right.
Yeah. But
right.
I mean, it's really been shortened to ultramarine now by just about everyone, because original lapis, just even today, is far too expensive to be on everybody's palate.
Absolutely. And also, we just can't continue to mine things out of the earth to turn into pigments. So, you know, chemistry becomes our friend in terms of finding other ways to create those colors.
Well, yeah,
such an interesting story.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I love that they're all, you know, there's so many happenstance and accidents along the way that lead to these discoveries. And it's such a fascinating history. Now, another beautiful historical blue, Mayan blue, which, as the name suggests, has a very ancient history, is another interesting story. But the Mayan blues that we see in paints today are a very recent discovery also. Can you tell us a bit more about that journey?
Yeah, they are indeed. So the, let's say, original Mayan blue, several thousand years old, I got my timelines confused there, but was rediscovered about 17 years ago. Some researchers at the University of Texas in El Paso were trying to recreate. So they'd got their hands on some of the original pigments, and they were trying to chemically recreate them, and in fact did. So and we kind of mentioned this before, that they made the blues and the indigos from the indigo dye. Now, normally dyes fade. You know, the difference between pigments and dyes tend to dissolve into whatever the media is you're using, and they really, light affects them quite badly. For clothes and things like that, that's fine, because you get, you know, a handful of years out of your clothes, and then you've probably worn them out anyway, so it doesn't matter if they fade. Obviously, we don't want our paintings to fade, so we use pigments for them. They're inert, they don't dissolve in the media they're mixed into. So to use a dye, and moreover, to have a dye that didn't fade, was quite incredible. And so they found this, made this pigment composed of palygaskite clay, which is a clay found just around the area that the Mayans used, with the indigo, and they replicated them. Yeah, and they're a really interesting, we make six different Mayan colors, and they're really interesting. The violet's stunning, is so are the two blues.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And, you know, it has that beautiful heritage, the indigo, with, you know, denim jeans. That's the sort of tone we're talking about. But, yeah, but it's a big process to get indigo from the plant.
Oh, it is. It is. Yeah, it is. But, I mean, I'm just going to say it's a little bit scary too, because what they did find, and especially the blue, where they found a lot of the blue, was in a well. But it was in a well with a whole lot of skeletons. So they think that what they did was actually painted the human sacrifices and then threw them down the well. So that little bit, you know.
That's a process you probably don't want to recreate to get
exactly. But it was a good source of a lot
so
of the blue.
Crazy stories.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, right. That's so interesting. All these little factoids. Well, I'm glad that they invented a synthetic version, and yes, you do have a beautiful collection of those in your company. Now, Yin Min is another accidental discovery that you also have a Yin Min paint colour that's made a big impact on the paint industry. Can you tell us a bit about what makes that so special?
Yeah, look, there's a couple of things. You're quite right. Another accident over in Oregon State Uni. Maz Subramanian is the professor. One of his students, they were trying to make semiconductors. And the way they do that, they take various different elements and whack them in a furnace and, you know, heat them up. Anyway, this one day been left in too long. And when they pulled it out, instead of it being black, which is what normally happens to me when I put stuff in the oven, it was this fantastic blue. And Maz had a look at it, and one of his specialties, electronics, and but also infrared. Now, a little side point about this was that that particular pigment actually reflects all the infrared spectrum. Now, that doesn't really worry us because we don't see infrared, but where it's a real bonus, hopefully down the track, is that for the roofs of houses and in hot climates, to reflect all the IR rays is fantastic because it has the potential to drop the temperature within the house of, I think it was 5 odd degrees or so, just wow, purely by using a particular color. But back to the story. So where it gets its name, Yin Min, actually is Y-I-N-M-N, which is yttrium, indium, and manganese. I think I got that right. Right. And the three elements that go into it. And part of the reason it's so expensive at the moment still is because the yttrium and indium are extremely expensive to extract. Hopefully, right, down the track, the thing is they're still using the sort of electronics high specification raw materials. And when they go into the oven, you lose some of it, but they could probably use much cheaper, raw materials with those elements in them, and it would make it cheaper. I certainly hope so, because we pay about $2,000 a kilo, which is
right,
more than 10 times more expensive than sort of standard Series 7 colours.
Okay.
But it's,
you must get so excited from your point of view to come across these new discoveries and be able to try them out as part of your range.
Absolutely. I love just, I mean, that's Maz, the professor, has been here to the factory. I gave a talk with him over in Greece a couple of years ago. And that just came from, I was reading about it and I thought, wow, this is really interesting. So I just emailed him. The wonderful thing about email. And he got back to me and he said, happy to have a chat. So we were the first ones to produce a paint on the Yin Min, and in fact did a run for Oregon State Uni, and they use it as presents and awards and things like that.
That's lovely.
Yeah, it's a matter of keeping an eye out and just jumping straight onto it. Yeah.
So fascinating. And just to finish up, Stephen, the latest scientific method of producing colour is photonic pigments, which is a whole other thing. Can you give us the short notes on what makes these pigments so revolutionary?
Look, if these things actually really, you know, they're just being produced in the lab at the moment, and once again, it was one of those things I read about, but if they get them to the point, and it's at a very young stage at the moment, but if they get them to the point where we can use them as pigments, they could be amazing, and amazing for artists. And the reason that is the way they work, and something that we didn't talk about, but you know, when you look at the sky, when you look at butterflies, peacocks, and this is especially relevant with blue, we're not actually seeing a blue pigment. What we're seeing is light being refracted or bent so that we see reflected back blue, the blue wavelength or wavelengths in the blue area. Phototronic pigments work in a similar way that they have, and so the way feathers and some of those things work is by having really fine cuts or holes in them that only let that or reflect that angle of that wavelength, hence the reason we see them as blue. And the reason we see the sky as blue, I don't know whether we touched on that, but the predominant particle size that we can see in the atmosphere bends blue light more than all the other light, and so that's why we see it as being blue. Okay. Mm. With phototronic pigments, the idea is that they, on a nanoscale, will make the pigments to order. So in other words, they'll have just the right angle, just the right hole size, if you like, for violet or yellow or blue or red, but not only blue, but red bias blue, you know, green bias blue, and so on. So you could put, and they will, in theory, they will not break down. So, you know, one of the problems with pigments, the pigments that we use are all very light fast, but eventually everything will still fade. In some of their testing, in theory anyway, these phototronic pigments, they're saying that they just shouldn't change. So that in itself would be a real boon, as well as being able to tune into any wavelength you wanted, in theory anyway.
Just so mind-blowing to imagine the possibilities of a paint that could do that. It's just crazy. I love it. And I love that it feels like the next logical expression of this science that has, you know, been the history of pigment down through the thousands of years of human history, that we should continue to play with this and understand it. So fascinating. Hey, look, we're going to have to finish up here. We haven't had a chance to unpack in damphrone blue or manganese blue. I think we could go on forever.
Or phthalo blue.
Absolutely. Or phthalo blue. No, we did talk about phthalo blue, didn't we? Yes. Did we?
No, we missed it. Anyway, that's cool.
We did miss it. Do you know what? We have to do it because, firstly, correct pronunciation of phthalo blue, please.
Okay. It comes from Thalassinian. So it's phthalo, so it's P-H-T-H-A-L-O, but it's pronounced Thursday, phthalo.
Thursday, phthalo. Thank you for resolving that for all of us.
Okay.
Now, I can't believe I missed this question that was on my list, because phthalo blues is what I mostly use, and phthalo greens as well, actually.
Really
Can
intense
you tell us
colours.
A little of that history of it being discovered by accident?
Yeah, once again, exactly right. Early 1900s in London, a couple of notable chemists, they discovered it by accident, noted it, but didn't do anything about it, which is crazy. But I guess maybe
it's been such a vibrant discovery.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And even compared to Prussian blue, whilst it's a transparent colour, it's still extremely strong. And a real staining colour, so it would have been fantastic. And it was another, I think, about 20 or 30 years when the Scottish Dyers Limited, I think was the name of the company, did exactly the same thing, that basically they had a crack. They were making thalamide, I think it was, and they had a crack in the glass vessel. And I'm guessing it must have been a copper vessel on the outside was the to make this thalamide, to heat it up. And through that, the copper, the insides was able to get to the copper, and they noticed this blue stain in a thing that was meant to be white. And at least they did something about it. You know, they followed it up, and actually I think that led to a patent. And now we have phthalo blue and also phthalo green that comes from that. Yeah, but probably outside of the art industry, probably one of the most used colours in the world.
Absolutely, and I adore it. Another story of the accident happened and they figured it out. So where would science be, or the history of paint, without accidents?
Indeed. Indeed, we'd be white on white.
Oh, it would, totally. Hey, thanks so much for joining me today, Stephen, and for sharing your incredible knowledge about colour and pigments and the history of blue, which has been absolutely fascinating.
Yeah, no worries at all. It's been great fun, and I hope everybody enjoyed it.
I'm sure they did. Hey, do you have anything exciting happening over there at Derevan that you'd like to share with us?
Look, we've got a few new colours coming out. And one thing though, and you know, we've been talking about making paint basically, where we will have a new page on the website on basically how people can make their own paint. And the one thing that's been missing is the anti-foam. So we'll have that available on there. But basically, yeah, how to take the rocks that you find when you go on holidays. So many people do this and it's fantastic as well, but they want to turn it into paint. And it's not, it is easy when you know what you're doing, but it's not as easy if you're not quite over it. So yeah, we'll have a webpage up shortly explaining how to do that.
Awesome. How exciting. This is music to my ears because I am one of those nerdy people that likes to collect pigment, and I mostly make my own watercolor actually, but I'm really excited that I might be able to access the ingredients and techniques to make acrylic. That would
be
amazing.
You'd be able to make watercolor or oil as well. It's really about the grinding of the pigment, and then from there you can take it off into various different media. Yeah,
absolutely. So, is the antiphone, is that for making acrylic though, or is that
predominantly acrylic? You might want to use it in watercolor. You wouldn't use it with oils though. Yeah.
Okay. Fascinating. Well, I look forward to checking out that link. We'll be sure to post it in the show notes so people can pop over and have a look. Hey, thanks so much for joining me, and I'm sure we will catch up at a later stage about another nerdy deep dive.
Some other colours.
Pigment of some kind. Yeah. Thanks,
perfect.
Stephen.
Sounds
all
great.
Right, everyone.
Thank you.
Catch you later. Bye.
What a fascinating conversation with Stephen. I could nerd out about this stuff all day, but it is time to go. Now, Stephen and the team over at Derevan Matisse wanted to offer our listeners a free gift today. So if you pop on over to the link in the show notes and follow the prompts, they will send you a delicious free tube of their gorgeous Mayan Violet structure paint. So be sure to pop on over to the show notes, hit that link and receive your free tube of paint. All right, keep well, everyone, and I'll see you next time. Bye. You can always see more of my art over at susannethercutt.com. And if you're interested in learning from me or checking out the podcast notes, you can find those over on susannethercuttstudio.com. I love hearing your comments and feedback, so feel free to leave a review on Apple Podcasts. And if you like what you're hearing, then why not snap a screenshot and share it in your Instagram stories? Be sure to tag me at susan.nethercutt so I can say hi. And if you've got a great idea for a future podcast episode or know someone who you think I should interview, then pop on over to susannethercuttstudio.com/podcast, hit the button in the header image to shoot me an email. Catch you next time.